Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is the man behind some very unique guitar amps called Third Power Amplifiers, and that's Jamie Scott. But first, let's talk about the Apple Beats deal, which basically there's more there than meets the eye. One of the thoughts I had is that the whole deal is not about buying Beats Music, the streaming service, and it's not about buying Beats Electronics for headphones and high-end audio accessories. It's actually for buying Jimmy Iovine. It's getting Jimmy Iovine on board at Apple. Now, if you don't know who Jimmy Iovine is, he's been a mover and shaker in the music industry for quite some time. He's not only the chairman of Interscope, Geffen, A&M Records, he's the co-founder of Beats Electronics, him and along with Dr. Dre. Before that, he started as an engineer with John Lennon, Bruce Springsteen, became a producer, and produced some really big hit albums, Tom Petty and Heartbreakers, Patti Smith. So basically, the guy's a pedigree. He knows music. He knows music well, inside out, upside down. He knows how it's made. But he also knows music business, and he knows it well, and he's played the game very well. And some might say that he has a vision that Apple doesn't have. And one of the things that I think is happening is Tim Cook, who's the CEO of Apple, kind of knows where his limitations are. He understands that he's a great operations guy, but he's not a particularly good vision guy, and that's what Apple really needed. And that's what they're getting in Jimmy Iovine, who's already agreed to become an exec, although we don't know in what capacity. So if you think of it from the standpoint of Iovine and Cook together, they don't quite make up one Steve Jobs, but at least they're kind of on the road to getting there. So I think really that's the reason why that deal went down more than anything. Now, if you look at it, there's a couple of things that you can also say. First of all, Apple really wins big here in that they have a streaming service that they can convert really quickly because it's pretty much together right now and all I have to do is brand it. They see that downloads are decreasing in the iTunes store and everybody's changing to streaming, so this basically gets them in the game. It also gets them in the game of high-end audio accessories. Now, one can say that Beats Electronics isn't best-sounding audio gear, but they make high-priced gear that has a brand and people like and people use, so that gets them in that side of the business. Beats wins, of course, because they get a big payout, $3 billion, and one might say that they were living on borrowed time. Now, if you look at it from the standpoint that, yes, they had some really deep pocket investors. They have Axis Industries. They have the Carlyle Group, who put a lot of dough into them, $500+ million. That being said, it's very difficult for a standalone company like that to stay in the game with an Apple, with a Google, with an Amazon who's getting into their own streaming business. So for them to sell out when they can right now is a good deal because probably this wasn't going to get any better for them down the line. They would probably struggle. It's obviously a good deal for Jimmy Iovine and Dr. Dre because they get to cash out. And for Dre, he doesn't become a billionaire, but he becomes a near billionaire and probably the most successful hip-hop artist ever as a result. There are losers, though. For instance, Apple is actually a loser in this as well, from the standpoint that they look weak. They look like they lack innovation. They have to go out of house to buy an existing streaming music service. Why couldn't they build their own, for instance? And of course, why are they getting into the high-end audio accessory business? They're pretty good at designing their own stuff. Why couldn't they do it themselves? So there's that. Some other losers, big losers, are headphone manufacturers. And when you look at it from the standpoint that all of a sudden there's some great manufacturers that were trying to jump into the space that they saw Beats Electronics carve out, well, now they're up against the giant that is Apple. And it's not going to be nearly as easy as it could have been for them. So they're a big loser in all this as well. There are some questions, though. So will Apple be able to deliver a streaming service that can rival Spotify now or anything that Google or Amazon will introduce in the future? We don't know that yet. Will Apple be able to marry some of their high-end headphones with audio products that matches the experience? So for instance, if you have a really good set of speakers, headphones, whatever, you need some really good sounding music to take advantage of that. So are we going to see that from Apple? Some high-end distribution, audio distribution? We don't know yet. Will the team of Jimmy Iovine and Dr. Dre prove that they have some magic that Apple really needs for future new product development? And we don't know that either. So we're going to see that pretty soon. I'd say in the next year, we're going to start to see the fruits of that. It probably will take about a year for that to happen. But in the meantime, Apple kind of looks good. Tim Cook looks even better by this deal. So we'll see what happens. Next thing I want to talk about are electric guitars. As many of you know, I like to go on cruises, and I go twice a year, and even more if I can. I just like cruising. And one of the things I noticed a few years ago, or started to notice, was the fact that all of a sudden there were fewer and fewer electric guitars in the bands on cruises, and then whenever we'd dock someplace, I'd go and I'd listen to a band in a club, and they wouldn't have an electric guitar player. And this looked like a trend to me that was happening. And I began to wonder, why is this? And the reason that I came up with is guitar players are loud. And it's just a fact of the matter. If you really want to get a really good guitar sound, you have to turn your amp up. And when you do that, usually you become too loud for the venue. So it appeared that on these cruise ships anyway, which might have four or five or more bands, depending on the size of the ship, there would be no guitar players in any of them. As a matter of fact, a few years ago, there was one that had a 7-string bass player. And I got to say, this guy was great. Usually, whenever you get past 4 strings, my eyes usually roll a little bit and think, okay, what are we going to have? Is it going to be bass player solo night? Anyway, this guy did do that in place of a guitar player, and he was great. It was actually someone who could pull it off, which is rare. But this last cruise that I went on, I have to say, guitars are back, and they're in every band, everywhere that I went. Now, it wasn't that they were screaming loud or anything, it's just the fact that they were actually there, and I thought that was pretty cool that maybe there is this lull in electric guitar presence in bands that perhaps is coming back. One of the interesting things is we're going to be talking about that, specifically about loud guitar players playing loud, turning your amp up, with my guest today, Jamie Scott. So stay tuned for that. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@BobbyOInnerCircle. My guest today is Jamie Scott from Third Power Amplifiers, whose users include Joe Walsh and Hunter Hayes, Lenny Kravitz, and just about every Nashville studio guitar player, as well as Simon Townsend from The Who, and many others. You can go on the website and you can check out the many users that Jamie has with his company. Jamie's also a great guitar player with a couple of major record deals under his belt. And he's also a recording and a mastering engineer as well. And he brings all of this to his unique amplifiers. I spoke to him via Skype from his home in Nashville. And here's Jamie. I'm here with Jamie Scott from Third Power Amplification, and I'm really happy to talk to you about one of my favorite subjects, guitar amps. Welcome, Jamie.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. Guitar tone is just, it's been a pursuit, I think, of a lifetime for me. So this is great. Love to talk about it.
One of the ways that I found out about you is by seeing Joe Walsh on television. I'm not sure what the show was. I think it might have been the Guitar Center show. But he was using these amplifiers that I had never seen or heard of before, called Third Power. And I immediately went on the internet and started to do some research. And I was really impressed just by your website and by the clientele you have and everything. So how did that come to pass, Jamie?
Thank you, first of all. And I appreciate, a lot of times things come so easy. You see it on TV, see it on YouTube, and you just kind of file it away and move on. So thank you for researching it and digging in a little bit about Third Power. The story with Joe Walsh is it's actually great, and I'm really excited about it. In 1997, I actually opened for Joe Walsh on his U.S. tour. And we connected at that point as musicians. I played a Red Gretsch country gentleman. And on that tour, I had slick back hair. I wore a suit and was playing, through a Fender Twin. It was kind of Chris Isaak meets the Mavericks flavor for that band. And I would talk about gear with Joe. So fast forward to now, I was doing work with a guy named Hunter Hayes. And Hunter Hayes and Joe did Crossroads together here in Nashville. This is going back, my God, time flies. So it's about a year and a half ago now. And at that session, I was there. Hunter Hayes' amps, and I remember during the taping, Hunter went and took his first solo, and Joe's head snapped back so fast at what Hunter was playing through. And by the end of the session, Joe's guitar tech came up to me and hi, introduced himself, Mark Reese, and went on, and he goes, Joe wants to talk to you about your amps. And I said, that's great. Gave him my number. I got a call about 3 weeks later, and it was Jamie, this is Joe Walsh, the guitar player. And it was just amazing. And so we started talking about guitar tone. And it was at that point that I kind of connected the dots to 1997. At Crossroads, it wasn't my place to say, hey, Joe, we know each other. No, it was stay back, support Hunter Hayes. But when Joe said, which one of your amps do I need? Then I let him know, I opened for you and I watched the set every night. And I'm no fool. I told Joe, you need one of everything. You could really cover anything in your catalog. And we enjoyed a great laugh, a great conversation. And he did buy the American Dream and British Dream. He asked me to deliver it. And I said, okay, where would you like it? And he said, well, I'm playing the Ryman with Ringo Starr tonight. Will you bring it over? So I was a guest of Joe Walsh. I stood on the side of the stage and watched him play. It's one of those, it's a pinch yourself moment, right? Here I am 15 feet from Ringo Starr on the drum riser and Joe Walsh. And it all came about from a phone call, and guitar tone. And so I'll never forget that. And it turns out they taped the Ringo Starr and the All-Stars video. The DVD video for that tour was taped at the Ryman, and Third Power amps were graced the front of the stage for that particular thing. So,
I remember seeing that, and the Crossroads with Hunter Hayes. As a matter of fact, both of those are played a lot on Palladia, I think, which is the high def channel, the high def music channel. I've been exposed to your amps at least on television. I'd love to hear them live because they're really unique. And let's talk about the uniqueness, because there's a couple things that I see. First of all, the cabinets, which I understand you have a patent for. And the other thing is the hybrid master, which is very interesting. So can you fill us in on that?
Yeah. Starting with the cabinets, honestly, I designed the triangle cabinet chamber in probably 1982. 82 or 83, I designed the triangle chambers. And then it's one of those, I did my first record in 82 as an artist and in just, seeking different things. I designed, I had drawn the triangle stacks and everything, and then did nothing with it until 2009. And it was amazing that I got that much runway. If you can imagine, drawing something in 82 and doing nothing with it, and in 2009, and I'll connect a couple of dots there, but in 2009, I had the opportunity to do it and kind of fulfill the vision. In 82, when I drew it, it's simply because it looked cool. It just looked different. Everybody's running square stacks and how, do something different. And I was playing a flying V, and I thought, okay, let's do triangle cabinets to go with the flying V kind of thing. Fast forward to now, I've had a lot of experience as an artist. I've been signed to Geffen Records, signed to Island Records. I was also a recording engineer and mastering engineer. At the time, as Pro Tools was emerging in Northern California, I was working at a music store called Bananas at Large.
Oh, I know it, sure.
And DigiDesign was right there in Daly City. So here they are with Sound Designer 2. Here they are with Session 8. Here they are with Pro Tools. And they're teaching me everything. We have NFRs of everything in the store. And I just, for some reason, I took to it like fish takes to water. And I'm being trained by the guys who are making the programs. And then the store would sell the stuff And guys like Louis Biancanello would buy the equipment. Vernon Black, these guys would buy the equipment and then book a session and then not know how to run it.
Yeah.
And so I get that last minute phone call. Jamie, get down here and run this session. I tracked a session with Herbie Hancock. And I mean, just, you know, legendary, and, you know, just incredible stuff. Yeah. So that really took off. And I started taking independent engineer series. I bought my own Soundtech EQs, my own Neve pre's. So I would show up at sessions with the good stuff. And we would do our overdubs through all the good gear. Meanwhile, I was pursuing my music career on the side of that. And the music career, that's where the, you know, I would say my passion of birth was to be on stage. So I'd take off, and that was the Joe Walsh tour. That pulled me, in a sense, out of being an independent engineer in the Bay Area and did that tour. So with that experience in mind, let's see. I'll connect a dot. Chips Davis is a studio consultant.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Okay. So while at Bananas at Large, I'm booking sessions for Chips Davis, consultations for all these guys doing their studios in the house. So Chips and I are now in the car together, driving out and doing these consultations, and we became friends. And he would share with me his concepts on studio design. Of course, I'm the sales guy, so he wants me informed so that I can continue to book him consultations and sell more of not only his services, but the gear that kind of works with that. So certainly a symbiotic relationship that turned to friendship. But it was through that studio control room experience that the triangles came back to me. Let's record great guitar tone. Lots of great amplifiers. Lots of great guitar players. Lots of great engineers, producers. The records that we fall in love with, it took all three. You had to have the guitarist, the engineer, and of course a great amp. But just a guitar player through a great amp, well, that sounded pretty good live, right? Front of house guy has to fix that. And same thing in the studio. And why can't a great guitar player plug into a great amp, set the channel strip flat, and play and have it sound like the record? I mean, there was, for me, the breakdown. And so I endeavored to fix that breakdown. I'm getting into a deeper part of the story, but I'll pull it out quick. So I would track guitar parts, favorite songs, and just play, and I would compare it to the record. And Pro Tools is great for this because not only can you look at the spectrum, but you can hear it. You can look at a waveform on a Jimi Hendrix track and see that it's really not heavily compressed. You can look at the intro of a Tom Petty song and see that it's really compressed. And then you can look at the frequency spectrum that both of these, I mean, that's completely different guitar tones, and you can see where the peaks are. And the more I analyzed guitar tones, the more I started to see a pattern. Throw in an AC/DC song, throw in a Bryan Adams song. How about we throw in a Van Halen song or Sheryl Crow? You started to see that a lot of these really look similar. And so I drew some conclusions there. And in order for me to replicate that, I would have to track the part and put in all these plugins and Pro Tools, and then I could match. And then I endeavored to redesign the amplifier, tweak the amp, and try to turn off one plugin at a time. I hit a wall where I could not tweak the amplifier enough to make the difference of what that plugin was doing. And it started to hit me what I had learned from, you know, Chips a number of years ago. And that was, and I started to see a pattern. There was dips in the frequency response and peaks where no matter what I did, I couldn't correct for a couple of certain things. And I looked back at the cabin. I said, okay, I got parallel walls everywhere. I've got speakers just taking care of business inside. And it's really a cacophony mess inside the cabinet. And it was those peaks and those nulls that was happening inside the enclosure that was creating a signature that I couldn't clean up electronically. And so I prototyped a triangle cab, put bass traps in the corners, and did kind of a live and dead end, kill one panel. It's a guitar cab, so we don't want to turn it into a studio monitor, but we want to control it. And that was my breakthrough. Once I did that, the cabinet was no longer the limiting factor. And then I ordered, you know, numerous capacitors made by different manufacturers, even if they're the same value throughout, whether it's filter caps, whether it's bypass caps on the cathodes or coupling caps for the various stages, and really started to log the difference in sound, because they can sound radically different. We've heard carbon comp resistors and metal thin wire, and those can also sound a little different. Carbon comps can be a little noisy, but they can work a magic if they're in. For me, I found one particular spot where that carbon comps really add their value. And if it's a vintage sounding voice, there's one specific place we have to have a carbon comp in there. So that's kind of a long story, but the cabinet, first it looked cool. Then it was a means to a sonic end that I was going for. And it led to moving from California to Nashville. I made a couple of demo videos that included the recordings of these guitar tones that I was working on. And every single person I reached out to, with industry veterans, musicians, professionals, I was simply saying, hey, talk me out of doing this. I'm thinking of pursuing this as a business. And I in a sense, knew I was crazy. I wanted my best friends and veterans in the industry to just talk me out of it. And every one of them said, not only can I not talk you out of it, I have to encourage you to pursue this. And one outfit, a company called Tour Supply based in Nashville, they have a Hollywood office. Yeah. They cater to touring professionals and the guitar techs. And I was friends with those guys and I showed them and they said, you know, we see a unique opportunity. This sounds incredible. We'd like you to fly out, bring an amplifier and make a presentation. And I did. And we struck up a partnership. They're certainly part of the story of Third Power. So that's why, in fact, we're here in Nashville. They wanted to help get the company going. And so they did. And we are now on separate paths. We're still friends. But that's part of the story that got us to Nashville. And that's the story of the triangle. And if you visit our website, you can see we're at thirdpower.com, 3RD. You'll see cabinets that have a triangle shape, or you'll see a square cabinet, but inside we embed the triangle with the bass traps. We do a switchback port, so you can have a cabinet and run it closed back, or you can take the port off and run it open back, and it's tuned so the low frequencies extend in a really great way. And
let me ask you a question. So what kind of wood are you using to construct the cabinet?
We're using Baltic birch as the primary shell. There is in certain, because we're embedding a chamber inside of a beefier structure, we may use certain panels, maybe a light ply or a thinner Baltic birch. We don't want to eliminate all resonance. But, you know, we've heard guitar cabinets out there. Pine caps have lots of resonance. It's part of the sound.
And which Fender uses.
Absolutely, yeah. And let's say a Marshall 412. That's a
dense, Baltic birch, yeah.
Yeah, it's a dense cabinet. And we're not looking to eliminate all resonance, but we're certainly controlling it so that electronically I can voice the amplifier. So the end goal was stick a mic in front of it, set the gain on your mic on the console, and simply push the fader up. You don't have to do corrective surgery to pull a great sound out of a Third Power. That was my goal. First was, I don't want to launch an amp company and just have another great amp. Mm. I wanted to create something that could get on the record. If the record could be cut with a Third Power, chances are the artist that tours that record, whether the guitar player actually was in the band, played on it. In Nashville, you've got a lot of studio guys that'll play on it, and then a touring musician. Well, if the record's cut with Third Power, that guy's chances of touring with my amplifier, they go up much greater.
Yeah.
Then from there, we can broaden out our customer base. So I think we're at that 4.5-year period, and guys like Dan Huff are cutting records. Chris Stephen, Paul Ebersold, Pete Kipley. It's almost exclusively Third Power records now, guitar-wise, so it's fantastic.
Well, let me ask you a question then. So, I don't know, I kind of look at the Marshall 4x12 as maybe a standard, and there's something to that. Just, again, it's the Baltic birch that they use, and it's the way everything is put together, and it's sort of ideal in some sort of way. So, were you trying to go away from that, trying to emulate it in a smaller cabinet, do something different? Well, I'm trying to get a comparison here to that.
Yeah, and that's a great example. I used to collect Marshall amplifiers and vintage ones. I had at one point 14 different Plexi 100 watt amplifiers. I was a 100 watt guy, and this was before I had any idea I would do this as a business. I have a logbook. I don't have it handy to show you here, you know, on the camera, but I have a logbook where I would track all of the operating voltages on all of these Marshalls, knowing it, the best ones, the voltage is kind of here, and the ones that maybe were a little muddy. And the thing about Marshalls is some sound great, some sound mad, some sound sweet, some sound muddy and mad, some sound edgy and sweet. It's like this moving thing. And out of the 14, I found two that were absolutely perfect. They were different sides of the spectrum. One was sweet and perfect, and one was mad and perfect.
Yeah.
And it was incredible. And so I, not knowing why, but I studied.
These are Plexis now. You're talking.
Yeah, Plexis. Yeah.
And 1959s.
1959s, yeah, 68s were my year.
Yeah.
Lots of other great Plexis, but it was the 68 Super Leads and Super Basses. That was my thing.
Yeah.
And so I just gravitated to those, and I just studied why. Just wanted to know why. Maybe to make myself a more informed collector and buyer at the time, but I still have that logbook. And I had vintage cabs. And the early voicing...
Which make a big difference. So the cabs are... And it's something that gets overlooked a lot.
Yeah.
But they do make a big difference.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, vintage cabs. I like the cabs up to about 72. I thought the cabs sounded great. And then they turned into what we call maybe more modern, even at this... But, you know, here we are in 2014, and a 72, 73, 74 cabs, very vintage. But those 68 cabs, 68, 69, 70, 71, just great years. Those cabs were great.
What? Why? Did you analyze that? Why were they particularly good?
You know what? That's one of those mysteries. It was, in a sense, you could say that lot of wood.
Yeah.
That, you know, that wood came from wherever their supplier was. And so you have this kind of this aging, and maybe it's a density. It's just that supply of wood of that time. And then the seasoning of all the years, you know, and
was it the speakers, maybe? It's the same 25-watt Celestians that go through that liner.
Yeah, without a doubt, the speakers were most certainly a part of it. And I had you know, the 25s, I call it the short magnet, and I had some of the 30s, the H with the big magnet. Both of those speakers were great. Both sounded different. You know, you maybe get a bigger Hendrix-y, you know, this dominating full spectrum sound out of the H magnets. I was I still am a Michael Schenker fan, and you know, plug in a Flying V into a Marshall with 25 watt magnets on there, the short magnets. I mean, you're cutting any UFO guitar track or Michael Schenker, you know, it's just a great, great sound.
Yeah.
So I did study the cabs. I measured and made my calculations on cubic volume, made my calculations on, right, if you've got the baffle board and a speaker sitting behind it, you have this much cubic volume isn't on the inside of the cabinet anymore, right? Because the speaker is coming in. So, and then the magnet is mass occupying space in the cubic volume. So I would make my version of those calculations, and I came up with a ratio. I don't have it handy, but I have it stored in an Excel file, so I can drop in numbers, and it'll tell me what size I want this chamber. And what I found was I came up with this. What's blown me away is no matter how small I make the cabinet, in relation to a 12-inch speaker, I'm able to get the sound of a 412 on that one thing by following this this ratio that, you know, from studying the cab.
Now, does that apply to other size speakers as well? If you went to 10s or on a small, let's say a small cab with an 8 or something, would that apply to?
You know, I would have to guess. At this point, I maybe it's overconfidence, but I think if I used a smaller speaker, I could find the right cubic volume. Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, the physics of it. If the physics say your box needs to be this big with this driver, your port needs to be this size with this driver and this cubic volume. So you get there, you get close, and then you stretch it out a little bit. You know, sometimes if I just follow the physics, the port maybe needs to be this size, but I find out on the mic and in the room, I actually need to expand or track the port size based on what response I want.
Well, let's talk about the electronics for a second. What I've always found is with people that are really into what they're doing, and I'm thinking specifically that there's a mic person, David Bach, who makes Bach microphones. And what he did before he made his version of a C12 is he did something similar to you. He went around to every rental company in LA and he got all of the best C12s and he put them side by side and did the same thing. Okay, this one sounds sweet, this one sounds harsh, and then reverse engineered it and tried to figure out why. And then, of course, built his version of what he thought the best was. So how does that apply to you in electronics, since you had a lot of, especially in the Marshall side, a lot to draw from? Did you try to go for the emulating a sound, or were you trying to take it to someplace where you thought it should be?
Yeah, I'd have to say, I'm nodding my head yes, but I am taking it. Every model amplifier I make, I am taking it to where I think it should be. I'm looking for a consistent sound. I'm looking for sound that sounds like a mastered record. And with a traditional cabinet and a traditional amplifier, there's too many things that still need an engineer to fix. You maybe have a buildup on low frequencies that's not appropriate, or you have a null in the mid-range that is just, it's not right. And so, if the engineer knows what he's doing and knows how to fix that null, he can fix the null in the right place. But one of the things that I from mastering records, I would get mixes that were pretty darn good mixes. Of course, lots of talented mixers out there. But if the guitar, if the pick attack on the guitar is at the wrong frequency, let's say it slid up at about 2.2K, 2.5K, that's right where the beater snap of the kick drum is, the click. Yeah. And so now you have energy that's competing with that. And so chances are they move the kick drum. It's easy. Just, grab the sweep and push it out.
One or the other. Yeah, right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Exactly. You move one or the other. And as soon as you start doing this, it's this domino effect. Things start moving into where the consonants are of the vocals. And now the cymbals, now you move those. And now it's this crazy thing. If you get the frequencies right the first time, it's on the track. The pick attack is where it needs to be. The less EQ, we know the less EQ applied at mixdown, the better the end result. And so you have to mic things, use the right mic, and right mic placement.
And placement, and, yeah, right.
Yeah.
But placement changes all that too. So
absolutely. And a little
that's
bit
a variable that you can't really anticipate.
Exactly. So here's my electronic philosophy. In some ways, I got lucky coming up with the triangle design and then the treatments inside like a studio control room, right? Bass traps, kill one, so that I could manage what the cabinet was telling me. And once it became managed, then I could electronically design through the choice of, a Marshall tone stack inherently has a 1K dip. And it's a big dip based on where you put the knobs. So we happen to like 1K on a recording, when it's all gone, it's one thing to have that in the room, to have it on a recording and have it mic'd up, to hear it over TV or hear it back on YouTube. We actually need that information there. And when you can correct the cabinet, well, I can choose a capacitor that may naturally be a couple of dB hotter than if this is the typical capacitor for that job. Well, I may have the same value made by a different supplier that might be 2 or 3 dB hotter at exactly the frequency I need without modifying the schematic, right? If I change a slope resistor, I can close that dip.
Yeah.
But if I can use the right component for that job, a 2 or 3 dB shift in the sound of a capacitor can get lost through a typical cabinet. In a recording environment, the detail or resolution of our monitor system will tell us absolutely what 2 or 3 dB is. Grab an EQ and just do a 2 dB, 2 or 3 dB thing and sweep through it. You'll hear it sweep.
Yeah.
If your monitor system isn't detailed, you'll do the sweep and you won't hear any shift. That's when I think you're not able to get a detailed job done. So once I got the cabinet done, I could do this detail work. I'll also mention two rectifiers. You get this great natural compression. What I found as a player, and that's, I think, one of the unique things is, yeah, I've got studio background, kind of both sides of the glass. Yeah. I've been on the studio side in the control room. I've been on the other side as the guitar player playing. So I want to please guitar players. I absolutely want to please and delight the engineer and the producer. And so getting the compression right is key. Tube rectifiers, I think they sound great. I'm not saying anything bad about them. Me as a player, I think there's about an 8-fret window on the neck where the tube rectifier works its magic. If you go down lower, let's say you play your low E string, you're playing stuff, you know, 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th fret.
Yeah.
I feel like as a player, the tube rectifier is too slow to keep up with me.
Yeah.
So I tend to play a certain way with that. And what I want an artist to be able to do is be fully free. Don't have a tube rectifier dictate how you're going to have to play.
Yeah.
And then the engineer may have to compensate for that and let's say roll off low end because the amp gets flubby down. I mean, take a Tweed basement, flubby low end.
Yeah.
Sweet. If you play blues at B or blues or in D,
yeah.
8th, 10th fret, 12th fret, I mean, it's the holy grail.
Yeah.
Play lower and it's this mushy, flubby, you know, so you got to roll off your low end.
Does that mean you don't use a tube rectifier?
Absolutely correct. I do not use tube rectifiers. I use a solid state rectifier, but I tune my power supply like I would dial in an LA-2A and just tickle the transients a little bit, give it a little buoyancy, you know, with how much gain reduction and how much makeup so that the neck, the full presentation of the guitar from open frets to the high frets, it's going to trigger the compressor in a way that's consistent from song to song, part to part, moment to moment.
Yeah,
I tune my power supplies to do that. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. The capacitors you choose in the power supply, the bleed resistors, right?
Yeah.
You can leave a power supply very sturdy, or you can make a power supply sag. But you're able, it becomes a consistent, in a sense, a slew rate of the compression. How it sags, I want the timing to be the same. And so I've achieved that on my amplifiers as well. So you plug in, you dial in the sound and on the amplifier, and then set the gain, push the fader up.
Let's talk about the Hybrid Master.
Yeah.
Because, of course, as guitar players, one of the biggest problems we have playing live is you're too loud. You know, I mean, and in a concert environment, even there, you know, you can overpower monitors, you can overpower people on the stage. You know, in every venue, basically, you know, guitar players have this problem of getting the tone at a reasonable volume. So
yeah.
I assume your Hybrid Master does something to help that along, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. My first amplifier was a 100-watt amp head. In 2009, we came out, our first amp was 100 watts. And what's been so interesting is, let's go back to like 1995. The guitar player still ruled the roost. The guitar player still played leads. He still had his big amplifiers. And the band and the support structure still really highly valued the guitar player. And I think there's been this erosion of guitar players. In some ways, they can't even get arrested today. You yeah. listen to pop music, there isn't a guitar player or a guitar lick anywhere. Maybe he's on stage as the token rock guy. So it's an interesting time. Country music has kind of filled that void where it's very contemporary, modern country. It's certainly lots of energy, very rocking, and it's guitar-centric, which is, you know, super for guitar players. But guitar players do have to conform in a sense. They used to run the show. Now they have to conform.
Yeah.
And one of those things they have to do is manage their volume. And yet all of us guitar players and all music fans love the sound of a cranked guitar. We just don't want to get inundated with the volume. And so that it creates challenges for the guitar player, challenges as an amp designer. how to do that. And there's a number of ways. We've heard of power scaling. We've heard of power soaks. Power soak is a means of, let's take the output of the tubes and let's convert that to heat. We're converting the energy from one form and dissipating it into another and having the speaker kind of be this thing that's in the middle at a reduced volume.
Yeah.
What motivated me was it's one of those, you know, if somebody steals your hamburger, you want to figure out how to not have your hamburger get stolen next time you want to eat.
Yeah.
I had a good friend of mine audition one of my amplifiers in his studio. This is going back 4 years. He got back with me a few days later. Oh my gosh, I love your amplifier. This is the greatest thing, you know, saying all the right things. And he said, can I keep it for another 2 weeks? I said, absolutely. Finish your session. Do your thing. I called him 2 weeks later, checked in. He goes, you know, your amp sounds great, but I bought somebody else's. And I said, okay. It's one of those, well, you know, you could have told me and I could tweak it for you or do whatever. And he goes, you know what? Your amp was just simply too loud. I couldn't use it in my environment. I'm really sorry. I love the sound, but it was too loud. And that's one of those, somebody stole my hamburger.
Yeah.
So I endeavored to look into, excuse me. I endeavored to figure out the various ways of reducing the volume. There's master volumes. You simply insert a pot in between one circuit and the input of another, and you attenuate the signal. And those types of master volumes, I felt, was effective only to a certain percentage of the sound.
Yeah.
At 100%, that circuit, that control is out of the circuit, the amp sounds great. Rolling it off, let's say 20% effective. Once you've gone past 20%, the amp starts to sound thin, that attenuation starts to kick in, and you can really hear the sound, kind of the quality for me disappears.
Yeah.
And so I write that down, master volume, good for whatever percentage it was. I'll just say 20% now. Then there's voltage regulation, there's power scaling. Everything I read, and I've plugged into power scaling amps and experienced it myself, what I found was people would say, power scaling works great if. And that was the part that triggers for me. I'm a fan of Apple products in that, for some reason, even my children can run an Apple product. There's no Apple's great if for me. Yeah. The user interface is slick, behind the scenes, lots of hard work is being done, but I can just touch it, use it, and enjoy it pretty rapidly. And so I want that for my amplifiers as well. So with the power scaling, it sounds great if, and that is reduce the wattage, but then you've got more distortion, so you've got to kind of go back to your preamp and now retune it for that volume level.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say you show up at the gig, and you can play a little louder. So you open it back up and now you retune your channel. Sound man says, hey, you know what? Actually, I need you to knock it down a little bit. So you have to knock it down and then retune. And for me, that's that user experience that I don't want for third power. The experience I want is, it's like you're driving in the car, your favorite song comes on, you grab one knob, you turn it up. You get a phone call, you grab one knob, turn it down. Phone call's done, you turn it back up. We're not re-EQing every time you have to adjust the volume. And it was that experience that I want. So here's, for third power, here's my channel. I have a volume control and I have my tone controls. If I need to turn it down, Hybrid Master is where I go do that. I don't have to change the channel here, turn this down here, knock three times on the corner, and then grab this other knob and hit click this switch, and then I find my sound. It's just simply has to be a real smooth execution of it. And so I looked at the various ways. And so the name Hybrid Master came about really because it's one part master volume. We are attenuating the audio signal, but we're also at the same time limiting the current and regulating the voltage. And now with Hybrid Master Plus, we've added an additional circuit that'll do an 80% volume reduction in one specific place without even grabbing the Hybrid Master knob. And that came about with my friend Kenny Greenberg. He's a studio guitar player here in Nashville. He bought one of our amplifiers. It was the Dreamweaver model. And when he came to pick it up, he's very sensitive to loud noise. So he came over and we plugged it in. I was ready to do this great demo for him. And Well, he said, can you turn it down? And so I turned it down. He goes, can you turn it down more? And so I turned it down more. And he goes, well, what do you, and he reached back and grabbed Hybrid Master and he immediately put it at what would be effectively an 80% reduction. And Hybrid Master will take you down to zero. I designed it to give you, let's say, a 10, 15, 20, maybe a 50% reduction. But I didn't design it to just do a wholesale 80%. And while it'll do it, I feel at 80%, you're kind of, now you're doing too much work in that circuit. And even for myself, I was like, I got to do a better job at this for him. And so I kept the amp for two more days. And I endeavored to find a way to get him that 80% wholesale, you know, drop in volume, but still have the amp sound fully alive.
Yeah.
This is one of those, as a designer, you know what your stuff's capable of.
Yeah.
And so he was perfectly happy grabbing Hybrid Master and pulling 80% out of it. I was listening to it going, you know, I want it to zing a little more. I want it to have a little more breath. He's like, well, it sounds good to me. I said, leave it with me for a couple of days. So I added the plus, which was another way. So all of it together, we can take, you know, a 100-watt amp and run it at 6 watts. We can take our 50-watt amps and, you know, and run it at 3 watts. And the sound and the resolution is fantastic. But I make 2-channel amps. So let's say my clean channel, let's say I dial in my AC30 channel, that's my sound. I dial in my plexi channel and that's, I play through those. Those are my sounds. That's how I'm going to play for the night. Hybrid Master is how you'll set the volume of that. You never have to go back and set one to play nice with the other. Once you have it dialed in, those are your sounds.
Yeah, that's
You'll regulate. Yeah. So Hybrid Master, the plus is the perfect. You're playing on TV. That's an environment where you have to immediately get to this low level.
Yeah.
And so Kenny Greenberg helped educate me on what that level is. And I came up with the plus portion of Hybrid Master to give him that sound. And then with Hybrid Master at full resolution, I could dial in any place that I needed to be.
Can you talk about your the models of amplifiers that you make? And I assume you're making a plexi version and an AC30 and I guess a brown face Fender or maybe a deluxe,
yeah,
you know, which are the popular ones.
Yeah.
Anything I'm missing?
That's in general, that's it. And obviously there's a number, what you just mentioned are the four cornerstones. I mean, black face, brown face, we can throw tweed in maybe touching on the brown face, but which is obviously another, in a sense, cornerstone. So maybe Fender gets to own three cornerstones from tweed, brown face, black face. Then there's, of course, Marshall. You could splinter that out if you wanted to go JTM, you know, 45 and then into the 100 watts. AC30s, AC15s, yeah. So the 58 AC15, 59 AC30. Then, of course, there's the early to mid-60s where the top boost comes in. You make an argument that high watts in there. There's lots that probably would be included, but I'm focusing on the four cornerstones initially in our, you know, in our first 5 years. If you had our American dream and our British dream amplifiers, you could cut virtually any record you needed to cut and range from classic, you know, those flavors of classics. And why not tap into the classic flavor of guitar tones? Because the entire walking population on the planet probably knows the intro to, you know, Satisfaction from the Rolling Stones. They've probably heard the intro to Welcome to the Jungle by Guns N' Roses. How about the intro to You Really Got Me? Both versions, the Kinks and Van Halen.
Yeah.
And then we can throw in, of course, Beatles songs and Tom Petty and all. But why not? If the population responds and those sounds already awaken, in a sense, your imagination, because songs will take you back. It's like the time machine for the ear that takes the mind on this journey. And so that's why I focus on the cornerstones.
Yeah.
We need to nail that. The American Dream, as you mentioned, covers channel one is a 62, 63 brown face deluxe. Channel two would be the 65 black face deluxe. Hmm. Here's the tweak on that. I have a basement flavored phase inverter on the American Dream. So early in the blackface channel, It sounds like the Deluxe. It's got the same tone stack. But as you open that channel up, it really responds to your pick hand. One of the things that, for me, a Deluxe, it stays clean very much through the dial. That's due to the phase inverter, the negative feedback circuit. It's a linear situation. Lots of negative feedback coming back into the amplifier that's keeping the phase inverter from distorting. It's keeping the frequency response smooth, and it's limiting distortion through that circuit. Basements sound wonderful on guitars, and sure enough, as you come, bring the volume up, you hit it with a little elbow grease on your pick hand, and you get this wonderful edge of breakup.
Yeah.
So my American Dream has a basement phase inverter with the front end of those Deluxe amplifiers. So you go from sounding Deluxe, and as you bring it up, the image starts to get really big. It's what we would want a Deluxe to sound like in the studio anyway. You bring the volume up here. You may hit it with a pedal to get a little grit. Brown faces will break up, I think, nicer than a black face Deluxe, by the way. So that's the American Dream. British Dream, I went back to the 59 AC30. So channel one is an EF86 voicing. Channel two is your 68 Plexi Super Lead voicing.
Oh, okay. Normally, that's very unusual, because normally what you'd have is either an AC30 or a Marshall Plexi or whatever it is, but not both of them in the same amplifier. So that's quite unusual, and it's very cool that you do that.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a challenge to achieve that outcome, because a Marshall and an AC30 have dramatically different phase inverters.
Yeah.
And as I was looking, the British Dream came to me first as a product name, and it had to have a Plexi, of course, because, as I mentioned earlier, Plexis are in my blood. So what's the accompanying channel? Is it a high watt? Is it a this, or what's it going to be? And so I started studying the history. I was intrigued by Vox, and I studied the history of Vox, bought a couple of books, read online, look at schematics, and then it hit me. Of course, an AC30, that would seem like an obvious. And then looking at AC30s, there was 50 Top Boost style boutique AC30s. I may be exaggerating, but
there's
My gosh, you could throw a rock, at your window and hit, a Top Boost style AC30 amp from somebody.
Yeah.
And so I dug deeper. What's out there? Of course, the British invasion beginning late 50s, there are lots of Fender amps, or some people would be surprised to find out lots of Fenders were on early British invasion stuff or early Beatles stuff. And of course, the AC15, which was an EF86 preamp on EL84s, on a pair of them, a wonderful sound. The 59 AC30 was also an EF86, but here's the kicker for me. It was a pair of EL34 output tubes. Marshall and Vox, for that 1 year, Marshall before Vox, or excuse me, I have that backwards, Vox before Marshall was on EL34s in 1959.
Interesting.
And so for that one year, an AC30 and an EF86 preamp with EL34 outputs, and it was Vox's response to Fender's The Twin that year. Oh, great. Grab our AC15. Take that preamp, put it on a pair of EL34 outputs. Now we've got the answer to Fender's The Twin.
Yeah.
And, and Vox scrapped that preamp design because when they went higher power, they had EF86s were microphonic. The amps were, Vox's in that year weren't the most rugged, and they don't have the reputation being the most rugged as any repair guy or any musician who's had to maintain one. It's a chore keeping your AC30 completely, on the road, trouble-free. That's kind of, those don't go hand in hand with AC30s. You got to keep them maintained. So Vox went with the Top Boost a couple years later, which was added a 12AX7 preamp, added an extra stage of gain, and the original Top Boost was just a panel they put on the back with an extra 12AX7 preamp tube and a volume and treble, a treble and bass control. And in a sense, it's a cathode follower, extra gain stage, tone stack, like Fender Bassman and like Marshall's later. they just had a really big, actually the Scoop is quite big. The Slope Resistor is very, very. I recall it being 100K instead of what Marshall uses being 33K. And Fender uses, depending on the model, 56K. So here's this big thing, but then you get the mid-range of an EL84 kind of making up for that Scoop. It's really part of that sound. But I leapfrogged that and went back to the EF86. And part of that was just, it's unique. And it wasn't a Me Too British Dream with just, an AC30 will grind and break up, very similar to a Marshall. It's just their signatures are different. But my gosh, that EF86 sounds very different. And as I mentioned before, the Matchless DC30, that's really one of the best, probably a top five product in the last 25 years.
Yeah.
Absolutely a wonderful product. And of course, that my favorite channel on that amp is the EF86 channel.
Yeah.
So, and one of the things I do as an amp designer, other than my time as a collector, where I would measure, I would open up the amp and measure the frequencies, or excuse me, measure the voltages. If I'm going for a Fender-based sound or this EF86 Vox-flavored thing, I'm not. I'll listen to original articles. I'll even listen to, say, a current make, but I don't open those amplifiers and copy them. I rely on my experience as a musician and my experience as a recording engineer. It's one of those, it's in my heart. I know if it feels right, I know I'm halfway there. And then it's embedded in my DNA. And if I hear it and it sounds right, I know I'm the other half. But when it sounds and feels right, then I know I've got the design. So I don't put out a product until it's sounding right and feeling right. And so I'm not cloning or copying.
Got it. Yeah. Well, this has been great, Jamie. Where can people find your amplifiers? You have dealers then, right, all over, yeah. I suppose?
Yeah. We certainly could use more dealers, but we're a small company. We're based in Nashville. We have a couple of Guitar Center locations that you can go to. We have the Amp House. We have Deluxe Guitar Exchange. We have Vintage King. And Vintage King is, you know, they've created their legend serving the recording community with all of the high-end stuff.
Sure.
And we're one of the amplifier brands that they carry. So that'd be a handful of our dealers. The Killer Vintage, I'm sorry if you're one of our dealers and I've forgotten you, but it's a handful.
And of course, people can find out more going to your website, which is thirdpower.com. It's 3rdpower.com. So thank you for being with me today. This was great. It was really enjoyable. I can't wait to hear one of your amplifiers. I can't wait to play through one because I'm so intrigued now just talking to you and knowing where you come from, because you're coming from the right place. You're coming from the places as a player, which you know, I can appreciate for sure. Definitely everybody can appreciate. So thank you very much, Jamie.
All right, Bobby, thank you. And where are you based at?
In California.
Okay, Southern Cal, Northern Cal?
Southern Cal.
Okay. I have a couple of amplifiers out there on some other demos, but as soon as they free up, I'll make sure something gets over to your place.
That'd be great. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jamie. Appreciate it.
You too. Bye.
Hope that interview didn't get too guitar esoteric. For those of you listening, we're talking about a lot of the minutiae of guitar amps. I found it fascinating myself. I hope you did too. If you want to find out more about Jamie and his Third Power amplifiers, go to thirdpower.com. That's thirdpower.com. It's the number 3rdpower.com. And you'll find out all about his company, all about the amplifiers, and all about the people who use them. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com, questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. I really do want to hear your comments on the show, things you like, things you don't like. It's all about improving the product, so let me know, and we'll incorporate any of the comments that you happen to send. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino, who's the host of EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com, and Steve is responsible for putting the show together. Thanks again, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby O's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com. At bobbyosinski.com, you'll find links to my blogs and coaching programs, as well as a sign-up sheet for my newsletter, and also for the podcast as well. This is Bobby Osinski. See you next time.